Okay. What was the size of the squadron, approximately?
I can't tell you the size, but I would say the number of aircraft would be about 30 to 40 aircraft of the type I was using, the Halifax and the Stirlings and the occasional Lancaster. We had one night we boarded three Lancasters from the Pathfinder Squadron. This was, we called Gibson Squadron, the Dambusters.
Guy Gibson.
And we warned them about the type of work we were doing and where to go in and all the rest of it. But by this time they had done the dam busting job, and you couldn't tell them anything. They didn't listen to us. So they went in through the Bay of Biscay. None of them came back. It's interesting. They were very nice men, but they got too brave. We also had a lot of Polish people in our squadron for a while. And they didn't last very long.
Totally Polish air crew?
Yes, totally. Yep. And
were they sent to Poland? Or did they go anywhere?
No, they sent the same as we were, but all they wanted to do was kill Germans, and they were very brave, and they hated the Germans, and
billeted separately?
Yes, I don't know where they were billeted. They weren't billeted with us, because most of them couldn't speak English. But boy, were they brave. Oh, they were very brave men.
Were there other Europeans as well, apart from Poles, in your squadron?
There were no French. Any Americans were in the RCAF or RAF. So basically, no, it was basically RAF and Canadian RCAF and Australians and New Zealand.
No Czechs?
No Czechs. And there was this few Poles for a while, and then we didn't see them anymore because they didn't last long. Brave as they were, I mean, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. You can't do that.
Can you just, for my information and for the information of people who are obviously not familiar with this kind of thing, can you tell us what happened when you knew you were going on a mission? I mean, like, when you woke up in the morning, what were the stages that you went through in preparing for a mission the next night?
All right, they tell us we were on, you know, you go to the board and they tell you whether you were on or not.
You'd and go to the where?
There was a board listing the aircraft that were on that night in chalk. It was written in chalk, and your crew and your aircraft and all the rest of it. So then you knew you were going to go on that night. And so right then, I mean, you knew it the night before. So that night before, you wouldn't drink. You just didn't drink. You got a good night's rest and all the rest. But then you were briefed. You went to briefing early in the afternoon. And the Met man was there. I think your father was that Met man, wasn't he? And they were wonderful, you know. I don't know. I still don't know how they did it. Here we've been having rain like mad in Vancouver for the last 6 months, and they can't forecast one day here with all the aids we have. But they'd say you'll hit a front over here and all the rest of it, and invariably they were correct. I don't know how they did. I think they're mosquitoes. The weather patrols used to go out ahead of us and bring them back information. But we'd be told what the weather approximately would be like and all the rest of it, and usually very accurate. So then we'd be told our drop.
You'd be told the location.
Location, what we'd be carrying approximately. Sometimes, like the night we carried the counterfeit money, they didn't tell us.
They just say canisters.
That's right, just canisters, yeah. But if we were carrying pigeons, they'd say there'd be pigeons, and you'd hear them anyhow. And so they'd tell us where it was, France, Belgium, Holland, Norway, and this sort of business. So you arrive, they tell us what the weather would be like and all the rest, and they tell us if we were carrying a Joe, an agent, or two agents, whatever it was. And we dropped them about 1,200 feet, which isn't very much room, you know, because they didn't want to be seen. So then we get over the drop zone, and we'd search that out. That's where I came into being with my good night vision. And there'd be three lights, boom, 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 in a row. And then over to the right of the last light would be a separate light flashing the signal, the letter PR, usually two letters, so you wouldn't mistake them. And that gave you your signal as to the right zone, the right drop. Also, it told you which way to drop. They wanted us to drop towards the... You go up the single line of lights and then drop at the last line where the fellow was to the right, so they wouldn't have to chase the canisters too far. And quite often you'd see them.
At what height would you be when you dropped?
About 600 or 700 feet. Quite often you see these guys scampering all over the place. Brave men.
What speed are you going at that?
Oh, the bomb bay doors are down and sometimes the undercarriage down. I would say just above stalling speed, and I've forgotten what it was. I would say probably about 100 miles an hour. Not very fast. And you'd try and make the drop as accurate as you could, because these fellows had to pick this up get rid of it very fast and get rid of the parachutes before the Germans got them. So if you made a sloppy drop, you were killing a lot of people down below. And they were very brave people. So we'd make the drop, and I always had one hand on the machine gun. I had a Vickers gas-operated machine gun. I think I told you, the first bombers I flew with a pan on it from the First World War, I had a hand on the machine gun as well as the bomb tit, so that if there was a German that captured the drop site, I'd get a few of them before they got me.
Did that ever happen?
Didn't happen to me, but it happened to some of my friends, I hear. Never happened to me, or I wouldn't be here, because you're a sitting duck. You wouldn't have a hope. If they were sitting there with some of their nice machinery that they had, they would have just blasted you out of the sky. But after the war, I read this book by Galen about Operation Nord Pole, and he had instructed his crews, his air crew as well as his ground crew, not to shoot at us, because he liked the stuff we were dropping to him. Isn't that horrible? We were dropping spies and guns and ammunition and everything else, and so he instructed the men not to shoot us down. That's probably why I'm still alive. That's interesting. If I ever meet him, I'll thank him. It's a funny thing, too, and another thing about it is you meet a lot of people who are in the service that hated the Germans. I didn't hate the German Air Force or the average German fighting man, not a bit. I thought he was a damn good enemy to fight. And he was, you know, he's like we were. He believed in his country, and he was told to fight, and he probably believed all the propaganda. But the ones I really didn't like, and I had nothing to do with them, thank God, were the SS and the Gestapo. That was a different breed. But you talk to any guy that fought the Germans on the ground or in the air, and they were a damn good, tough enemy. And if they'd ever captured Air Force men, a lot of my friends were captured, and this Jim Piercy that's in Vancouver, they treated our boys beautifully. They respected them, because we were good fighters, which is nice to hear, if there is such a thing as a good fighter, and I think there has to be, unfortunately.
Of course, lots of people you were dropping,
yeah,
like the Joes, were in fact actually fighting really the SS and the Gestapo.
That's right, and they killed them, and they tortured them horribly. Some of them were women. There's one woman, I've forgotten her name now, that was captured. She was part East Indian, beautiful woman. Did you ever hear that story?
Yes, I know about that.
Oh, boy, they really gave her a rough time. They killed her.
What proportion of the agents you dropped were women? You mentioned one who went to Norway.
I think very few. I think there was about, all the people I dropped, I must have dropped about 30 or 40. I'd say of the 30 or 40, I'd say only about 5 were women. But it takes a gutsy woman to do that work. Boy, oh, boy, it takes a gutsy person. We dropped one guy into a German ammunition dump by mistake. It was a correct drop, but we didn't know it was a German ammunition dump. It was in a forest. And he came back with a Lysander and told us about it and kidded us about it.
Is that right?
Yeah, he got back. Yeah.
And was he sent off again?
Yes.
How you came across him again when he came back?
See, they couldn't talk to anyone.
Right. I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah.
What was the nature of when you first meet, if you had a mission which was dropping a drill.
Uh-huh.
Well, let me ask you two things, first of all. You went on 40 missions.
41.
41.
Yep.
You said you dropped about 30 or 40...
People.
People.
Yeah.
Now, that wouldn't presumably be over 30 or 40 missions. It would be, say, would there be 3 or 4 agents in a drop?
Sometimes two. Usually two. Two.
Oh, I see. Yep. So that would make roughly half your missions would be dropping people.
Yep. And that was, you had to really be on your toes to know what you were doing with them, because they were very highly trained people.
Tell me about a mission where you had an agent. When did you first meet them?
First of all, they wouldn't tell us anything about him. They wouldn't tell us where he was going or what his job was or anything like that.
Yeah, you'd have to know which country you were going.
That's
to.
That's right, yeah. They'd say you're to drop him over there in France. Most of them are French or Belgium or Dutch, and Belgian or Dutch and or Norwegian, and we'd just take him to the area and drop him. But in this one instance, why, I don't know. The fellow we had dropped somebody had goofed into this middle of this forest, which was a German ammunition dump. When they got him back, they called us in and said, he wants to talk to you. And he's a very nice guy, a Frenchman, and he joked about it. Very brave man. But normally, we never saw them again. We just dropped them, and that was it.
And you just picked them up just before the plane was loading up.
Quite often, they didn't even let us see their faces.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, they were very well protected. It was very secretive work. I mean, for all we knew, some of them were Germans. Highly placed Germans. One night I had two very high French military men on the nose of my bomber wanting to see all the equipment and everything and what I did and all the rest of it. Who they were, I don't know, but I don't even know what their ranks were, because I don't know the French rank, but I knew they were way up, and all they could say was, "Kill Bosch, kill Bosch." They hated the Germans. "Kill Bosch." And then they looked at me and said, "Where are you from? Where are you from?" And I said, "Canada." "Oh, you speak French?" And I said, "No, I don't speak French." And I said, "They said, what's your name?" And I told them, that's not Canadian. I said, "Italian." And I said, "That's right." Then they really looked at me. They were surprised.
Very suspicious.
Yeah, very suspicious. Yeah. There weren't many people of Italian origin in our Air Force. Very few. Very few.
Which was the most dangerous destination in general for you? Where do you least like flying to?
They were all about the same. My nature, I don't like boredom. The trips to Norway I found completely boring, absolutely boring. You know, it's such a long trip. It was 8 or 9 or 10 hours. That I didn't like. I prefer excitement. The most dangerous thing we had was one night we were dropping this fellow, this Joe, and two other aircraft had carried him and tried to drop him near Paris. This was shortly before D-Day, and they couldn't find the drop site, and so they said it's our job. So we took him in, and this night we got really low level, and so they were really after us. They really tried to shoot us up, and that was the worst trip we had. We had holes all over the aircraft, the tail of the aircraft, but they didn't hit us. Didn't hit any member of the crew. But I'd say that was the one of the most scary trips. And that night, no, not that, and another night, we almost hit another of our aircraft over a drop zone. About, I'd say, 6 inches. That is scary. That's scary.
Was that someone else from your own squadron?
Yes. Yeah. Sometimes we had two or three of our aircraft.
I see.
Yeah, going over the same drop zone. And that is scary, because if you hit at that altitude, you're a dead man. But the worst trip was my last one, the ditching.
Mm.
That is a hell of an experience.
Mm-hmm.
You hit water and it's just like cement. You remember, all the lights go out and the gas tanks break and the guys moan and groan. And I kept saying, "Take it easy, guys. We'll all get out." And a hand pushed me down. This sort of business, it's survival.
Yeah.
And that's not much fun.
Yeah.
That's not much fun.
What kind of training or advice were you given about what you should do if you did have to force land or crash land? What were you supposed to do?
Well, we had identity cards. We always carried our identity cards with us that could be easily made into a false identity card in Europe. Our photographs were on it. We were supposed not to put up a fight. It was ridiculous to try and fight. I don't know if I told you, we were each issued a Smith & Wesson 38 revolver. None of us could hit anything with it. So I stopped carrying mine, because it was more danger to me than the Germans. And we were told to give just our rank, serial number, and this sort of stuff that when we were captured. Not even our squadron, strictly our rank and serial number and our name. And that was it. And we were to try and escape. This was paramount.
To try and evade. I mean,
yes.
Not,
oh yeah.
Not actually be kept.
Oh yes. Oh no. Not
what,
to.
What guidance did they give you there?
Well, we had maps. We had these silk maps. Did you ever see them?
I think I have seen them.
Beautiful things. I wish I'd kept them.
A long time ago.
Oh, they're beautiful maps, on silk, on sort of parachute silk. So that if they got wet, it didn't do any harm. And we had compasses and our buttons and our tunics. We put two buttons together, and one would point to north. And part of our training was they'd dump us on a lorry in Britain and dump us in the middle of the night somewhere and say, "Now get your way back to the squadron, even if you have to steal a car," which we tried to do, and we got caught. But they were escape-minded, and they said, "Try and get out if you possibly can." And your chances of getting out were very good if you had the courage. Like, if you didn't, like this first pilot I flew with, this warrant officer, I can just see him walking along the road in the rear and say, "Here's one of ours." This Jim Piercy, that got caught, a good friend of mine, he was shot down over Holland. And the reason they got Jim and his crew is they were walking along the road. They were dispersed. The crew were all over the place. And they wanted to all get together, so they started singing "O Canada." Now, that's not a very bright thing to do in the middle of a moonlight night, is it? So they captured them. The Germans thought, "Aha, oh, Canada doesn't belong here," so they captured them all. But the underground was infiltrated pretty well by the Germans, too, you know. Infiltrated.
Everywhere?
Yeah. They were pretty smart boys. Pretty smart boys.
Did they give you any advice about if you landed in Europe, that you could try and get in touch with the underground or anything like that?
No. They They purposely didn't do that. They didn't give us any names, because if they did, a lot of guys would have squawked under torture and stuff like that. But they said that usually get to a farmhouse away from civilization, and if the farmer won't help you, he certainly would try and lead you to where the underground were. He might not help you, you know, might not let you in, but he'd probably give you some milk and stuff like that, but he'd tell you who to contact. I had my own ideas of what I would do.
What would you do?
I would have contacted a Catholic priest, even though I'm not a practicing Catholic now. I used to be. But the priests, the Catholic priests and the nuns were very good about helping escape, helping our men. And the people that helped most of our downed airmen, this is a joke, were whores, prostitutes. They had more guts than anyone. If they were caught, they were shot, you know. Anyone that helped a person shot down airmen or anything like that escaped. But the prostitutes were very brave, and they hid most of our guys. That's funny, isn't it?
You weren't advised to get in touch with prostitutes?
No, 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 but I'd heard about it. So I thought, well, it's the best place to hide I can think of.
The priest rather than the prostitute.
Yeah, one or the other. One or the other. Yeah.
Did any of your attempts of people get shot down and actually manage to get out and come back?
I never saw them if they did.
You never heard about them, so you didn't. You couldn't. Learn
well, yeah, my friend Jim Piercy, he got back after the war.
Yeah, but I mean during the war.
No,
no. To escape,
he only did. Poor Jim only did six trips.
Uh-huh. Where he was shot down in Holland.
Yeah. Six trips. Yeah. Hmm. So no, I never saw them. Anyone that came back. And I heard later on that the what we used to call the chop rate, you know, the survival rate, was very, very low because of the light ACAC and hitting obstacles. You know, you're flying at 600 or 700 feet. You don't have to hit many hills before you're down. We lost a lot of good men, a lot of young men. One sad thing, we had two twins in our squadron, two RAF kids, twins, and they were in the same crew, which they should never have done, and it went down. They stopped that. They wouldn't let brothers fly in the same crew. Eventually, they wouldn't let them fly in the same squadron, which I think is good. These two kids were both shot down. I don't know if they survived or not.
Do you think your casualty rates in 138 were higher than in other kinds of squadrons? Do you think regular bomber command had worse casualties?
Probably were. I think not from the enemy action, but more from hills hitting stuff. You had no fighting room. You see, if something went wrong, you're 600 or 700 feet, and say you lost two engines or one engine, all of a sudden, bang, you're into a hill. But not from enemy action. Mm-hmm. It's from low-level stuff. Like, we always flew very low.
Mm-hmm.
Going across the channel, we flew right at wave top, and we'd pull up over the cliffs, you know, and this sort of stuff. I liked that. It was fun. But you sure as heck had to know where you were.
You had to know exactly what you were doing,
right.
Where you were.
That's right.
You usually flew on clear nights?
Yes, moonlight nights if we could. We almost had to, because most of our work was map reading. You couldn't navigate that accurately, you see. You could try, but it wasn't that good.
So, I mean, how many nights of a month are there when you can actually fly?
There aren't very many. That's why it took me about a year and a half to do my 41 trips. That's it.
Because presumably also the moon has to be in a certain phase.
That's right.
Is that right?
That's right. That's
so
right.
So what would it be, 5 or 6 nights in the
about
month?
About that. Yeah, it's about that.
When everything is right.
Yeah.
The moon and
sometimes
the
we wouldn't have a full moon, you know. We'd have a quarter moon or the sort of stuff. But it was, this is why it took us so long to finish a tour. And So, but I didn't mind. As I say, it was a very interesting squadron. And there was very little discipline in our squadron if you did your job. If you didn't do your job, even though you were an officer, you were shipped to a place called Sheffield. Have you ever heard of it?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a discipline squadron, station. And boy, they shipped you there real fast. They didn't care what your rank was. And you sure learned to mind your P's and Q's there.
Can you remember the name of the squadron leader? Tempsford?
Which squadron leader?
Well, 138. I mean, the
group captain.
The group captain.
Oh, yeah, Fielding. He was the king.
Fielding.
He was the king's pilot.
Uh-huh.
He wore red in his tunic. Oh, yeah, he wasn't very friendly, which you understand, of course, he didn't want to be. But it was Group Captain Fielding, and he was the King's pilot, and he ran a very tight ship. But he didn't care about, you know, about saluting and the polished stuff, as long as you did your work. But if you didn't do your work, you sure heard about it.
Did he get to know you in any way?
No. I met him, and when I left, he congratulated him. And Flight Lieutenant Jaffe, the adjutant, drove me to the station when I finally left Tempsford, and he cried. He said, what are you going to do? And I said, I think I'll be a dentist. And he said, I just want to know tell you how thankful I am. He said, I want to thank you very much for what you've done for us. And big tears were running down his eyes, which I thought was pretty nice.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, I still remember him. Jaffe, J-A-F-F-E.
How many people have these people have you kept in touch with?
None.
None of them.
Isn't that strange? The only one I know in Canada is Hiram Walker. You know what he was? He was a banker. Isn't that strange? You know, you think of a banker, and you think of a... Most people think of a banker as a dull...
Kind of stuffed shirt.
Stuffed shirt, yeah. And he was far from it. He did two tours. Hiram Walker had the DSO and the DFC. And you don't get that just by eating cornflakes. Pretty good, isn't it?
That's very good.
I've never heard of him. He's probably back there. I've never been back east since the war. I shouldn't say it. I did once. But I think he's in Ottawa, and I went to Toronto to pick up a motorhome. And it was colder than the devil. I could hardly wait to get back here. But someday I'll look him up.
Mm-hmm. As far as you know, he's still alive.
As far as I know, yeah.
Is he about your age?
Oh, no, he was much older. Mm. He was much older. I was 19, and at the time I was 19, Hiram was about, 30, 32. So he's older than
me. So he's in his 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
A hell of a good pilot.
Had he had pre-war experience of flying?
No. No. He was the same as I was. And he was a very odd guy. He didn't believe in spit and polish. He didn't believe in rank segregation. He didn't like the fact that some of our crew were sergeants and we were officers, and he didn't like us being separated. He thought, and I think he was right, he thought we should all be together, because we're all in the same boat, but they wouldn't do anything about it. That's the setup.
How were you segregated?
Well, we lived in different billets, different messes. We had different parties and everything.
Yeah, you actually lived on the base. You
yes.
Billeted out.
No. We lived in the base. Yeah. Mm. We had bat women. They used to bring us tea every morning.
Bat women to bring you tea.
Yeah, which is pretty nice.
That's pretty nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was the food like?
Lousy, horrible food. Like, I couldn't even imagine kippers for breakfast. You ever had
delicious?
Kippers?
I love kippers for breakfast.
I don't mind kippers for dinner, but I don't like them for breakfast. And
was that pretty standard?
Yeah, it was pretty standard. And what else was there? Brussels sprouts. I've never eaten so many Brussels sprouts. They grew them there like mad. It was about the only vegetable that they could grow, apparently. And even to this day, every time I taste a Brussels sprout, immediately I think of the war. Isn't that funny? Yeah. But they did the best they could. I was healthy. I came back, and boy, I was thin. All my Italian relatives thought I was dying because I was so thin. They'd serve me these pasta meals, and I couldn't eat them. And they'd say, oh, poor Tom, he's sick. And I wasn't sick. I was in good shape.
So it was nutritionally good food?
Oh, it was adequate. It was adequate. I remember meeting a Canadian in London on leave one night, and he said, would you like a steak? And I said, would I like a steak? I hadn't had a steak for so long. I said, where are you going to get a steak? He said, in the black market. I said, good enough, let's go. So he led me down to all these mews. I always get a kick out of these mews. Are they muses or mews? I don't know.
Mews.
Is that the plural of mews?
I guess it is.
So we get to this restaurant, and I'm all set for a nice big steak, and he brings the steak, and I could hardly chew it. It was horse meat. But I ate it. It wasn't bad.
Meat?
Sure. Really? It wasn't bad. It was tough. Oh, it was tough.
Did he have much contact with civilians in England while you were there?
Not too much, but the contact I had, I liked. I liked the people very much. Once I got used to them, and once they got used to me, I found them a very tough people, gutsy, lots of guts, which I like. And once they got to know you, very friendly. Took a little while to get to know you, longer than it does here in Canada. But once they accepted you completely, absolutely completely, and I like them. No, they were good people. I made a lot of good friends over there.
I know you. Surely you wouldn't tell them what you were doing. But do you think that they knew what 138 Squadron was doing roughly?
No.
Did they realize you were a special squadron mm-hmm. of any kind?
Mm-hmm. Tell you a story about that. We were asked when we wanted to go on leave. There was an organization called Lady Riders Organization. Did you ever hear of it?
Mm-hmm.
And she organized a thing for people from the from Canada and places that wanted to go on leave. And so you filled the form out and said what you wanted to do. So Jim Piercy, this fellow and I, when we first arrived on the squadron, we were horseback riding. So we get this thing inviting us on our next leave from Lord and Lady Shaw in southern England somewhere. I can't even remember where it was. Come and visit with us on your leave, and we've got horses. So Jim and I had never ridden a horse. We just thought we'd like to ride a horse. So we get there. Have you ever ridden on an English saddle?
No, I can't even ride a Russian saddle.
Holy cow. I couldn't walk for 2 days. But, oh, were they good? He was, I think he was an admiral in the Navy, in the Royal Navy. And so after we got there for a couple of days, he said, now, what do you chaps do? We said, well, we're in the Air Force. We're in Bomber Command, which we weren't in Bomber Command. That's what we were told to say. And he said, well, he said, you're not in Bomber Command. He knew, you see. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, I happen to know that 138 Squadron isn't in Bomber Command. He said, I'm not a dummy. And so we got there. I said to him, well, look, Admiral, I said, we can't tell you what we're on. We're on a hush-hush squadron. That's all we can say. He said, I am too. He said, I'm an hush-hush warrior. He said, you tell me and I'll tell you. And I wouldn't. I said, no way, no way. So Jim and I went out. He liked that, though. He respected us for it. We went out one night, and we came in about 2 o'clock in the morning, and it was all blacked out. We were a little tipsy. So we walked into the thing, and I tripped on a stool, went flat on my keister, and I started to giggle. And prior to that, everything was very formal, and that's all. I broke the ice. From then on, we were good friends. They both came down laughing like mad, you know, and joined in on it. They were good people, very good people.
Did you ever go back?
I haven't been back to
Britain. No, I mean go back to horse rider.
No, no, I really am not a horseback rider. I spent nearly all my leaves in London. I got to really like London.
What did you do when you went to London? Movies? Or?
No, parties. We used to. There was a couple of hotels in Britain, in Piccadilly. All the air crew used to go to. I joined the Wings Club. There was a Wings Club that only Air Force people went to. It was a lot of fun. And then there was the Regent Hotel, Regent Palace. You ever heard of that hotel?
Yes, the Regent Palace Hotel.
Yeah, and it catered to the Air Force. And we used to stay there. And I remember going, I think that's where I look like I'm bald in that photograph. I went there, and I never had a manicure in my life. And I think it was a Fruity Barber got a hold of me, and he was saying, oh, you should have your nails done and this done. And he gave me a shampoo. I never had my hair shampooed in my life. He cut my nails and everything. I thought I was King Farouk. we're a bunch of kids. And I guess that's why we pulled through it.
Why do you say that?
I think we're foolishly brave. Foolishly brave. And you can't beat a soldier like that. A person that's brave does a lot of crazy things. If you're timid, I don't think you last long. You're afraid to take the chances that pull you through. And we were foolishly brave. I think it's a very good term for it.
You said that you joined us because you had something to prove.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that was true of a lot of the other people?
I think so.
Who volunteered for 138?
I think it volunteered for all the services. I think a lot of fellows that went in the services had a lot of things to prove. I think especially people of foreign extraction, like from Canada and the States, more so from Canada, though, because Canada was then primarily an Anglo-Saxon country. And if you weren't Anglo-Saxon, you were looked upon as a second-class citizen many times. I mean, I was hurt many times going through school in Kelowna. So I had all this stuff to prove and get out of my system, and I wasn't the only one. There were a lot of guys. I mean, the guys like Tchaikovsky's and all the rest of these guys, the Poles, and even like one of my best friends was Frank Kuber of German origin. And I said, Frank, how did you feel about bombing Germany? He said, didn't bother me a damn bit. But you see, he was a foreigner too. He came from the prairies, this sort of stuff. And it's interesting, isn't it, how he had, I asked him about it. I said, did you have a few things to prove? He said, oh yeah. He said, I really did. And
was he on 138?
No, he was in Bomber Command, and he became a lawyer. But the sad part about all of this is that most of the guys in my age group, I think I mentioned to you last time, have either become alcoholics or have committed suicide. That's sad.
Any explanation for that?
I don't know why.
Maybe the war was a real high for them, and afterwards they never managed to experience again the kind of excitement.
I don't know. That's sad. Bill Alto, my dental friend in Shaughnessy, has gone through all the records. He was an instructor in the Air Force, so he had an interest in this. And he mentioned this to me one day. He said, you know, you're a very lucky man. And I said, why? And he mentioned this. He said, nearly all the guys we've got records on, he said, they're either complete alcoholics or they've committed suicide. That is sad, isn't it?
That is sad.
Yeah, because they were good men. God, they were good men.
Do you think any of the people, looking back on it now, with, you know, the experience you've had and so on, looking back on the people you knew in 138 Squadron, who were all, I gather, volunteers.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Do you think any of them had particular reasons that you know of? I mean, were they extraordinary characters? Were they eccentrics, or were they people with chips on their shoulders? Were they people who were foolhardy? You mentioned the Poles being a bit foolhardy.
Yeah.
I mean, would you say they were slightly different from the norm of people who were in the services?
Well, I'd say, first of all, the people from England, I think they were people that really wanted to do something for Britain. They really felt threatened. I mean, they were justifiably, because Britain was damn near went under. And I think they were defending Britain, very much so. And they joined the Air Force because they probably liked the uniform or wanted to fly or something like that. But I think, other than that, if you cut them out of it, I think the other people from Canada that I knew, sure, I wanted to defend Britain. I thought the best way to defend Canada was to defend Britain. But I wasn't as gung-ho as they were. I had an English instructor that, holy cow, I'll tell you, if you made a mistake, he used to run up one side and down the other and say, now look, you're not doing this right, and the Germans are going to kill you, and I don't want you killed because I want you to kill Germans. And that's how rabid he was. And I never met a Canadian like that in my life. Never. But this English fellow, that's how he felt. He was very positive about it. And so he should have been. We were, to me, you know, I hate to say it, but a lot of this was a big adventure. Isn't that crazy? Sure, it was dangerous, but it was like, actually, it was a high, what the kids call a high now. Every time I flew, I got to the point where I didn't think I could be killed. Now, isn't that crazy? I really thought I was indestructible. And I really got a kick out of it. I got a kick out of finding the target. I really liked that. Because I, you know, it was my job, and I got a kick out of making a nice drop. And I got a kick out of thinking, well, there's a few hundred Germans probably not going to make it because of me that night. And I liked that. But I wasn't rabid about it like some of these RAF kids. And they were. What, some of their parents had been bombed, killed, their wives had been killed, and this sort of stuff. It would have been different if this had happened to me. But they had a different outlook. And I had this big chip on my shoulder. I had to prove, you know, that I was as good, if not better, than most of the kids that I went to school with. And, mm-hmm. and I was a very sensitive young man, and too much so, I realize now. And I had all this damn stuff to get out of my system. It's tough to get out of your system. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've run into any of that. I run into it with a few of my friends, and we've talked about it. And it affects your whole life. It still does, even today. That you feel, oh, God, now why wouldn't they let me into that club or this sort of business? I understand how some of the Jewish people feel when they won't let them into a golf club just because they're a Jew. That's not right. It's wrong. I remember even after the war, I wanted to join an officer's club down here at Point Grey, and I was going with Mac Carter, and Mac Carter's a nice Anglo-Saxon name. They accepted him holus bolus, but they didn't accept me. That hurt, and it wasn't bloody well right. I'm still annoyed at it. And you never get that out of your system. I don't think you ever should. So it goes on and on and on. Funny world.
Yeah, so I can see how you would maybe, you know, give them a chance to volunteer for some special duty. You'd really want to go in there and just show them.
That's right.
Show someone.
That's right. Yeah. And even in my work now as a dentist, I've gone out of my way to work a little harder, study a little harder, be a little better, and this sort of stuff at my work. It's not all bad. It's a good thing, I guess. But it's hard on you.
You're a little bit uncharacteristic in some ways from a lot of the people I've talked to. You, on the whole, you haven't kept in touch with the people that you were with during the war. Why is that? Is there any reason you can put your finger on?
No, I'm basically a loner. I think maybe that's it. Like, my hobby is boating, but I'm not a... I've joined a yacht club. But I'm not a typical yacht club person. Like, my idea of boating is to get away from the yacht club. Most people that join a yacht club want to go out with 40 ships all to one harbor and tie up bumper to bumper and this sort of stuff. My idea is going into a little secret cove where there aren't anyone, no other boats. And I am a loner. I have very few close friends. A lot of acquaintances, but very few close friends. And part of that's my work. Most dentists are like this.
Right?
Yeah, we work with people a lot, all day.
And so you want to get away
from them. So we want to get away from them. And lawyers are like this, too, and physicians.
Teachers are a bit, too.
That's right. You're working with people all the time, and each one takes a chunk out of you. So when you, for your free time, which I treasure very much, boy, do I treasure my spare time. I like to get away, like already this coming week, this long weekend, the Easter weekend. It's a bad weekend to go out in a boat. Usually you get the hell kicked out of you. But I already got plans to go. And I'll go. So, but I would like to see Hiram Walker. I'd like to see my navigator. His name was Shepard. He was an RAF kid. I would like to see him.
The navigator, no.
I was the bomb aimer.
But wasn't, I thought it was a navigator who was killed. I'm sorry.
And that was my first navigator.
Oh.
My second navigator was killed. Shepard was my friend. And he'd done some trips with the first pilot, the second pilot. And so he did about 15 trips with me. And then,
he completed his tour.
He completed it. So then we got this fellow that was killed.
So he was an English guy.
That's right. Both of them were. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
He used to work for Rolls Royce.
Do you know his first name? Shepard. Shepard's first name?
No, we used to call him Shep.
Shep.
Yeah. I can't remember his first name. He had a beautiful sister. I remember her. That's not allowed.
No, we've got to stop the tape at this point.
Okay.
You were just telling me about some of the psychological pressures on crew.
Yeah, it was quite interesting that we were hit with the psychology, as I mentioned before, that none of us were going to finish the tour, that we to relax and to do a good job. But there were some of the men on the squadron didn't make it, but invariably they were the older fellows. The younger fellows, like 19, 20 years of age, seemed to glide through everything with no fear. Like I basically was not frightened after my first five trips. Towards the end now, when I realized that I had a chance of making it.
Then you got afraid.
Then I got scared. The expression was, you could cut my eyeballs off with scissors. They're sticking out so far. But the last four trips, because prior to that, I thought, well, I'm not going to make it anyhow. I said that I was, earlier on, I said I figured I was indestructible. I figured I was indestructible, but I had accepted death. Isn't that a funny thing? Antagonistic, isn't it?
How can kind of contradictory, yeah. But perhaps with some psychological...
Yeah, I don't know. I wasn't scared after the fifth trip till about my last trip, and then I got frightened. But
What about the old... You were mentioning the older guy, some of the guys who cracked up, or...
Yeah, well, as I told you about this one pilot I flew with, and we get in the middle of the channel,
right.
And he'd say, uh-oh, and he was permanent RAF. I mean, he wasn't reserve like I was.
Sort of what age was he?
Johnny was about, I'd say 35, 37. Spit and polish, you know, his hair cut beautifully, his uniform beautiful, his boots polished and everything, and he knew his aircraft, he knew ground stuff and everything. And he, about halfway across the channel, he'd say, look at the engine pressure on that side, Tom. And I'd say, the oil pressure. And I'd say, He'd say, look at the temperature on that other engine. And I knew very well what he was going to do. He was going to turn around and go back, and that's what he did.
Was there a fairly big kind of dropout rate of people of that age?
I don't know. You just really got to know your own crew. You'd hear stories, but invariably the stories were all about people that were over 35, around that age. And I think they they knew the risk more than we did. We were sort of dumb. That's what it amounts to, dumb brave. And that's what they like. I mean, that's why every Army or Air Force or Navy likes young men, because you believe everything you're told and you do what you're told. Can you imagine these Japanese kamikaze pilots? Boy, if anybody had ever told me that the best thing I could do was dive a bomber into a battleship and I'd go to heaven, you'd never convince me of that. But they believed it. They believed it.
Mm. Do you actually see anyone apart from your first pilot who kind of cracked up in some way on 138?
No. I never saw a real nervous breakdown. A friend of mine now, as a matter of fact, he's a dentist too in British Columbia. Wasn't on my squadron. He was on another squadron on the Hamptons. You ever see those Hampton bombers? Oh, they were the first bombers. They were a horrible bomber. And they were shot down by the Germans very easily. He did about six trips, and his nerves went, he told me about this, went completely, absolutely completely. His hands shook, everything. He just couldn't handle it, and they took him off and put him on ground crew. I don't know what he did, but he said he just couldn't hack it. Just couldn't hack it. And I know of another guy. Well, it's... German, fellow of German origin, I was telling you about the lawyer. He messed his pants over Hamburg one night. He was that frightened.
I gather that was fairly common.
That was quite common, apparently, yeah. And other people vomited like mad. This navigator I flew with now, whether it was from fright or not, I don't know, but he just couldn't navigate. He got so airsick. I think part of that was fear. But they shouldn't have stamped his logbook. I mean, if a person's frightened, he shouldn't be doing that job. Not for his own sake, but for the rest of the crew as well. He jeopardizes the whole crew. A lot of us develop what was called a twitch. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
It's a muscular twitch, almost a facial twitch, and your shoulder goes with it. I developed it after I ditched. Most of the younger guys got over it fairly quickly, but some of the older guys didn't. They still have it. And it's this. You do it. The facial muscles twitch, and the shoulder comes up and twitches as well. And it's a nervous twitch from tension.
And did it continue long after you?
Mine kept up for about 3 weeks. I had it, and after I'd finished, and this friend of mine heard that I ditched and finished, and he came down from another station where he was training, and he'd already done it to her at Temsford. And he came up to me, and I had a mug of beer in my hand, and he had a mug of beer, and he came over, and he said, "Tom, I'm glad you made it." And I went in a twitch, and I threw the beer all over him. And yet everyone realized it was a... It's funny, they didn't laugh really, you know, they didn't laugh at you, they laughed with you about it, because it was so common. I've seen people in this civilian life, in tough business world, get the same thing. They don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. But I still say, he's got the twitch. And that's what we called it. The operational twitch.
This is just a note for the end of the tape. Tom Caccioni downed in the Mediterranean on the 11th of July, 1944.